Today is Friday, July 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, a power-sharing agreement has been reached in Sudan that aims to increase the transition between the military rule to a civilian government. Talks between the Taliban and the U.S. are paused, but that may not be a bad thing.
Both the sides have almost resolved their issues that were preventing them from finalizing a draft set.
And scientists say the ice around Antarctica is shrinking. Those stories and more are ahead on today's International Edition. Sudan's ruling military council and a pro-democracy coalition reached an agreement to share power during a transition period to civilian rule, including the formation of an independent government led by a prime minister. On Friday, both sides showed gratitude to the African Union envoy, Mohamed El Hassan Labat, for his diligence in helping reaching this point. Mohamed Hamdan Dalgo, the deputy head of Sudan's Transitional Military Council, thanked the African and Ethiopian mediators for their efforts and patience. He also thanked the Forces for Freedom and Change for their good spirit. He wanted to reassure all political forces, armed movements, and all those who participated in the change, from young men and women, that this agreement will be comprehensive and will not exclude anyone and will also reach up to the ambitions of the Sudanese people in its pure revolution. The leader in the Forces of Freedom and Change, Omar al-Daguer, said a nation that is like its revolution, one that suits its greatness, its noblesse and pride. He said the agreement opens the path for establishment of transitional bodies, which will begin executing reformation programs in all social, political, and economic aspects, the first of which is the issue of peace and the independent, transparent investigation and punishment of the killers of the martyrs. The emerging deal, after 2 days of intensive talks in Khartoum, could break weeks of political impasse since the military ousted President Omar al-Bashir in April. Talks on a power-sharing agreement collapsed on June 3rd when security forces attempted to disperse a sit-in protest outside the military's headquarters in central Khartoum. More than 250 people have been killed since an uprising erupted against al-Bashir in December. The Taliban and the United States paused a seventh round of negotiations Friday for a day, making good progress over the past 6 days to reach an agreement on the withdrawal of foreign troops from Afghanistan. In addition, Taliban officials are due to meet a group of Afghan delegates in Doha this weekend as diplomatic efforts build to withdraw foreign forces from Afghanistan and end years of violence that continued this week with a devastating bomb attack in Kabul. For more on these talks, I spoke earlier with reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad. Ayaz, what can you tell us about these talks between the United States and the Taliban?
Well, Steve, as you know, the talks began 6 days ago, and today they have paused. Both the sides decided to pause the negotiations just for a day, and they will resume the discussions on Saturday. But what we know so far from these discussions over the past 6 days is that both the sides, if you go by what the Taliban are telling us, have almost resolved their issues that were preventing them from finalizing a draft text on the two key issues, which are, the withdrawal of U.S.-led foreign forces from Afghanistan in return for guarantees that the Taliban would not allow transnational terrorists to use Afghanistan for attacks against U.S. or its allies.
Given that situation, what was the rationale for pushing pause on the talks today?
Well, you know, basically what we understand from our discussions with the Taliban is that they needed some internal deliberations after conclude, holding these uninterrupted talks for 6 days and coming to some kind of a final understanding. They still needed to consult their top leadership. And also, the Taliban say they need some kind of preparation for an intra-Afghan dialogue, which will begin on Sunday.
Turning ahead to Sunday's talks, can you give us a little preview of what we can expect to see?
the Taliban has they have held like two rounds of intra-Afghan talks, mostly with the opposition groups in Afghanistan, and those talks were hosted by Russia in recent months. So that is sort of a continuation of that same process. But what is different now is that for the first time, the Taliban has agreed to allow Afghan government representatives to also be part of this group of Afghans who will be holding talks with them in Doha. And although both the organizers of this meeting, which are the governments of Germany and Qatar, and the Taliban themselves have clarified that Afghan government officials will be participating in these discussions as in their private capacity. And you know that the Taliban is strongly opposed to holding any negotiations with the Afghan government unless and until it secures a withdrawal, a troop withdrawal agreement with the United States.
Ayaz, what else do we need to keep in mind when looking at these U.S., Afghan, and inter-Afghan talks?
Well, everybody is anxiously waiting, but what is significant about all this Afghan peace process is that Pakistan seems to be now playing really a leading role because it has reached out to Afghan President Ashraf Ghani, with whom, Pakistan has had a very tough time because Afghan President continuously suspected Pakistan that it is sheltering the Taliban and it is helping this insurgent group to orchestrate attack in Afghanistan. So in the last few weeks, we have seen that Pakistan has tried to reach out to Afghan leaders, and Ghani also visited Pakistan last week, and he spent two good days. And what we understand now that a Taliban delegation, senior level delegation, might be visiting Islamabad for a meeting with Prime Minister Imran Khan, because that will be a big deal in a sense, because President Donald Trump's administration has been pressing Pakistan that you have facilitated the current U.S.-Taliban dialogue, but they want Pakistan to do more to really convince the Taliban to show more flexibility so that a reasonable peace agreement is finalized.
That was reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad. Student unions from two Hong Kong universities said Friday that they have turned down invitations from city leader Carrie Lam for talks about recent unrest over her proposal to allow the extradition of suspects to mainland China. The invitations followed a pledge by Lam to do a better job of listening to the voices of young people. Student leaders said at a news conference that they don't think Lam is being sincere. And the students say any meeting should be public and include a wider representation than just them. And here are other major stories from around the globe. Turkey state media says an explosion inside a vehicle near Turkey's border with Syria Friday has left two people dead and two others injured. A former leader of Iran's powerful Revolutionary Guard said Friday that the Islamic Republic should consider seizing a British oil tanker in response to authorities detaining an Iranian oil tanker off the coast of Gibraltar. A magnitude 6.4 earthquake rocked Southern California Thursday morning, jolting residents of the region and resulting in several fires and minor injuries in the town of Ridgecrest, 180 kilometers northeast of Los Angeles. Aftershocks continue to shake the region. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on our website and with the VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, historically black colleges and universities in the United States have also educated prominent Africans, like the founding presidents of Nigeria, Ghana, and Malawi. The role of historically black colleges and universities on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Need a little Straight Talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A UN report accuses the government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro of extrajudicial killings and repressive measures aimed at neutralizing political opponents. Lisa Schlein reports that UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, presented that report Friday to the UN Human Rights Council.
The report presents a grim picture of a society where people are killed, arbitrarily arrested, tortured, and deprived of the basic commodities needed for survival. It reports a shockingly high number of alleged extrajudicial killings by Venezuela's security forces against so-called criminals purportedly resisting arrest. Michelle Bachelet, the UN human rights chief, says perceived political opponents and human rights defenders are subject to threats, smear campaigns, and widespread abuse, including torture, sexual violence, killings, and enforced disappearance.
Excessive and lethal force has repeatedly been used against protesters. My office has also documented excessive use of force in the context of security operations by the Special Action Forces, with multiple killings mainly of young men. Many could constitute extrajudicial killings and should be fully investigated, with accountability of perpetrators and guarantees of non-recurrence.
The government's own figures show 5,287 people were killed during security operations last year, and another 1,569 people were killed through mid-May of this year. The UN cites other sources who suggest the real figures may be much higher. Bachelet warns Venezuelans will continue to flee their country in unprecedented numbers if the abuse does not end and the dire economic situation does not improve. She says the situation is devastating livelihoods and shortening the lives of the most vulnerable.
Many basic public services have all but collapsed, including transportation, electricity, and water. The healthcare sector is in critical condition. The non-availability of basic medication and equipment is causing preventable death, while non-availability of contraception forces many women to bear children they will not be able to adequately care for.
Bachelet blames international sanctions, mainly affecting oil exports, for worsening the economic crisis. Responding to the report, Venezuela's Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs, William Castillo, tells the UN Council there is no humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. He says his country, like others, has economic problems due to many factors. Despite this, he notes, his government is maintaining peace and democracy and providing for the needs for its people. He flatly rejects the criminal accusation against the military and security forces of massive human rights violations. He agrees there have been occasional excesses, but says his country has the right to protect itself against certain security risks. He says the report does not reflect the reality in Venezuela and demands its contents be corrected. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Greek voters appear set to defy a surge of support to support populist parties across Europe in a general election Sunday, with the pro-EU center-right opposition firmly in the lead. Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras called the snap poll after being trounced in May's European parliamentary elections and several months after his coalition with a nationalist partner collapsed. It followed a grueling 4 years in office for Tsipras, largely defined by economic hardship and a slow recovery after Greece limped out of an international bailout. The government's main rival, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, conservative New Democracy Party, is ahead in the poll. The first results are expected around 1900 hours UTC on Sunday. After a U.S. trade official said trade talks between the U.S. and China could begin in days, China now has put a possible wall in the path of a possible agreement between the two countries. China's official Xinhua News Agency says China has insisted that all tariffs on Chinese imports added by the United States during the trade war must be scrapped immediately, as part of any deal to end the year-long conflict that would presumably require the Trump administration to give up its position that some levies remain in place even after an agreement has been reached. Jeff Moon, the former assistant U.S. trade representative for China, spoke earlier with my VOA colleague, Ira Melman.
Jeff, does this come unexpectedly?
No, it sounds pretty familiar. Actually, after trade talks broke off in early May, Vice Premier Liu He announced three demands. One was this tariff demand. The other was that the purchases China would make be, quote, realistic. And the third was that there be a, quote, balanced text in the final agreement. So this is consistent with the core demands that China has been making now for quite some time.
So what do you expect the U.S. reaction either has been already and not publicized or will be?
I think that the U.S. negotiators will see this as a part, one of the issues that will be resolved in the end game. This is something that the U.S. also attaches great importance to, and this was part of the enforcement of how we're going to sort of enforce any kind of an agreement. The question that I have is actually, what are the terms of that agreement going to be? Are they worth enforcing? I think that's much more important than these other issues.
So with the talks set to resume, does this put a barrier right in front of them that was not expected? Again, you said you expected it, but what about the whole U.S. team, the whole U.S. negotiating team?
No, I think that they expected this. As I said, this is a principal Chinese demand. They have been hearing this for quite some time from the Chinese, and they will deal with that. This will actually be a presidential decision because it's the president that has attached great importance to tariffs, and only he will decide when those tariffs come off.
Now, this does not include the tariffs that were originally levied by the Trump administration. Is that correct?
Well, it's not clear. There is so much here that's not clear. You know, for the 20 years that I was an American diplomat, after we had a summit, we always had a joint statement that defined exactly what was agreed, what was going to happen in the short term, what was going to happen in the long term. We have none of that here. So there's no clarity as to the precise terms. And the parties have nonetheless decided to re-engage without that clarity.
So where does this stand? This seems to be no progress whatsoever. That's what I hear you telling me.
I think things are pretty much where they were before. But the psychology of the trade talks has changed considerably. Up until negotiations broke off, China was basically trying to preserve the status quo, which included a $350 billion trade surplus. Around May 10 or so, China took a decision that Trump's tactics were more of an existential threat to China. And so that's why you've seen the ramp up in the anti-American rhetoric. The Chinese have hardened their position considerably, and you see that in the official press. And so it will be more difficult for China to make the compromises that are going to be necessary in order to reach an agreement. You hear a lot of talk from the Chinese about equality and mutual benefit. And frankly, I think that the Trump administration would be wise to take them up on that language and point out that there really isn't equality with a $350 billion surplus, and there isn't mutual benefit. And we ought to talk about the areas where Chinese are welcome to participate in the American economy, but Americans cannot participate in the Chinese economy.
That was my VOA colleague, Ira Melman, speaking with former Assistant U.S. Trade Representative for China, Jeff Moon. The United Nations Security Council is condemning a deadly attack on a detention center for migrants near Libya's capital and is calling on the warring parties to urgently de-escalate fighting and commit to a ceasefire. The UN's most powerful body also called on the parties to rapidly return to UN-mediated political talks. You're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the Voice of America.
Thank you.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The sea ice around Antarctica has plunged from a record high to a record low in just 3 years, according to a new report released this week by the U.S. space agency NASA. Dr. Claire Parkinson is an earth scientist at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, and VOA's Faith Lapidus has this report.
While sea ice in the Arctic Ocean at the top of the world was steadily melting, Antarctica's ring of floating ice was steadily growing until 2014.
In just 3 years, as of 2017, it reached its 40-year record low, and that was 10.7 million square kilometers. So altogether, in that period of 3 years, it lost a little over 2 million square kilometers of ice. And that's a little bit larger than the area of Mexico.
More than 3.5 decades of Antarctica's ice game vanished in just 3 years, melting more rapidly than what's happening in the Arctic. The scientific consensus is that the loss of Arctic sea ice is related to both air and seawater getting warmer. Researchers are still looking for an explanation for the dramatic decline in Antarctica.
After 2014, when this huge decrease happened, there are some attempts to try to relate it to something going on in the atmosphere or the oceans. And there have been some indications that maybe, like in the Weddell Sea, it could have been warm air coming in from the north. And in the Ross Sea, it might have been slightly different reasons.
Whatever the reason, the trend has far-reaching implications for the polar ecosystem and the Earth as a whole. Unlike the bright reflective surface of ice, dark ocean water absorbs sunlight, trapping heat and leading to a cycle of continuous warming. Scientists are still doing research in Antarctica, looking for explanations and solutions. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Scientists in Australia say they have used artificial intelligence to develop a powerful new vaccine against the flu. Phil Mercer reports the team from Flinders University believe it is the first time a computer has used its own machine learning to design a new drug for people to use.
The computer's name is SAM, or Search Algorithm for Ligands, and Australian researchers say its new flu drug is a turbocharged version of existing treatments. The key to the technology are adjuvants, which are substances that help existing therapies work better to prevent infection. The artificial intelligence program was fed information on influenza vaccines that work, as well as those that don't, and left to its own devices, without any help from scientists at Flinders University. They say it's the start of a new era in artificial intelligence research. Dr. Nikolai Petrovsky is from Flinders University in Adelaide.
We took existing drugs that we know work. We took examples of drugs that don't work or have failed, and we essentially showed all of that to the AI program called SAM, came up with its own suggestion of what might be an effective adjuvant, which we then took and tested, and sure enough, it worked.
A clinical trial will soon start on 240 volunteers in the United States. It's sponsored by the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, part of the U.S. National Institutes of Health. The World Health Organization has said the 2019 influenza season appeared to have started earlier than previous years in Australia, Chile, South Africa, and New Zealand. The disease kills many thousands of people around the world each year. More than 115,000 influenza cases have been reported in Australia, and authorities say 226 people have died so far this year. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And that's going to do it for us today. On behalf of our director, Dan Brown, engineer Nick Ivanoff, and managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, videos, stories, and more, be sure to follow The Voice of America on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, with our VOA mobile app, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a fantastic Friday and an amazing weekend.